a cold world. Harlem's in China. Oh, what began in Charleston is now done in London. Everywhere from Podunk to Paris
to Pittsburgh
to Peking to Charleston in South Carolina.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio. It's this week on Broadway for Sunday, June 25th, 2017. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast today, we have Michael Portantier and Ron Fassler. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us is Ron Fassler. Ron is a film and television actor and author. We have spoken with Ron a number of times on Today on Broadway and This Week on Broadway. Most recently, we talked about his new book, Up in the Cheap Seats, a historical memoir of Broadway, which chronicles Fassler's years as a teenage theater goer from Long Island and his Newsday route, if I can jump in there and mention that, and includes more than 100 interviews with Broadway theater artists, and it was published in February of 2017. Ron, thanks for jumping in.
Oh, my pleasure. Great to be here.
So for listeners, I got an email from Peter on Friday evening, Saturday morning, saying that he's out of town. His flight got rescheduled and he wasn't going to make it back in to record this morning. And Ron was great enough to jump in Peter's stead and join us for this week's discussion. So thank you so much.
Part of my resume is a professional understudy on Broadway and off Broadway. So filling in for Peter Felicia is tough, but I think I've got the credits behind me to back it up.
Who did you understudy? Anything interesting you could tell us about that?
I've understudied Sean Penn and Kevin Bacon in a play called Slab Boys way back when. I understudied Chris Sarandon, Peter Riegert, Michael Jeter. I've understudied a lot of people.
Oh, Michael
I may have mentioned it. I saw Slab Boys.
Oh, boy.
I don't think
you were. The old Playhouse. Yeah, before they tore it down. Yeah.
Well, that must have been back near 1984, wasn't it?
Good segue, James.
Well, there happens to be a play on Broadway right now at the new/old Hudson Theater called 1984, which Michael and Ron have gotten a chance to see. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with 1984?
Well, I was really very curious about this because obviously the timeliness of any adaptation of the eerily prescient novel by George Orwell, real name Eric Blair, by the way, that was, I always had it in my head that it was published in 1948. It was technically published in 1949. But obviously he was working on it in 1948. And so the 84 really represents a reversal of those two integers. I wonder if he considered calling the novel 1994 when he found out that it wouldn't be published until 49. That would have given some extra time for this horrendous vision of the future that he wrote it would have given it a little more time to come true and theoretically be more believable in the sense of the amount of time it would take for that to be happen for the world to become this totalitarian nightmare where everyone's all citizens every movements are observed through telescreens installed in their homes and the thought police are everywhere trying to keep everyone in line and there's rationing and just it's really such a horrible, scary, scary world that Orwell created. I don't know about you guys, but I read the book in junior high school. It was on our junior high school syllabus and it's amazing because it's as horrific as it is, it's really quite simple. The concepts of it are very simple. They're not that esoteric in terms of the horrors that are depicted. And I kind of think, it's hard to say looking back that long, but I think I really got all of it. I understood all of the novel on a really basic level at the time. And now when rereading it, it just all comes back. So anyway, this is a stage adaptation of the property. It's adapted and directed by Robert Icke, I suppose you pronounce his name, I-C-K-E, and Duncan McMillan. This comes to us from England. It was a co-production of the Headlong Nottingham Playhouse and the Almeida Theater over there. And now it is at the newly reopened and renovated Hudson Theater on Broadway. So that's an exciting aspect of the whole experience. It took me a while to get into this adaptation because there's a framing device that is used that I did not expect. And honestly, I don't think it's 100% successful. In fact, I think it's counterproductive to a certain extent. There is a epilogue that Orwell wrote to the book, to the novel, and this framing device is sort of based on that, because the epilogue that Orwell wrote makes it sound as if it's something that was written long after the events of the novel, and implying that totalitarian regime was eventually toppled. That is what they tried to recreate, Icke and McMillan, in this framing device that they use. But I don't think it really works completely. Another very odd thing about this production is one of the strengths of the novel is that it takes place in a locale that is very obviously recognizable as London. About 95% of it is London, and then there are maybe a scene or two in a suburb or somewhere outside of London. So that makes it all the more chilling, because you know landmarks are mentioned and churches and things of that sort. And it's the specificity of that, the setting, only increases the horror. Well, this production, for some strange reason, is set, it seems, in America. All of the cast do American accents, including Tom Sturridge, who plays the central role of Winston Smith, and he is British. So he does a not convincing American accent, and the rest of the actors, who I believe I guess probably all of them are American. They do American accents, and there are references to places like Westchester, and another local city is mentioned. But then there's also a British nursery rhyme that keeps recurring. So all of that just was a little confusing, and I think that was a mistake. I think they should have just left it set in London and England. There have been previous adaptations of 1984. There's a 1956 film version, which apparently was not well regarded and was unavailable, it seems, for many, many years. Now it looks like you can, in fact, order it through Amazon. I remember seeing that as a child on TV, and then I guess they lost the rights, so they stopped showing it. And then there's a far more successful film that was released in 1984, starring John Hurt and Richard Burton. So that is something I want to check out. In fact, they recently had a free screening of it somewhere in Manhattan. I don't know if you guys read about that, but I couldn't make it. Anyway, so there are a lot of flaws and oddities to this production that is currently at the Hudson Theater. But I will say that for me, the power of the words themselves, Orwell's words, and also the acting was quite excellent overall, despite the few things that I just mentioned. Tom Sturridge is Winston Smith. Olivia Wilde is Julia, the woman he's in love with. They have this clandestine romance, because they're not supposed to have any romance in this terrible future world. And Reed Burney plays O'Brien, who Julia and Winston at first think is a friend of theirs, but then turns out to be a high-ranking member of the party. And one of the centerpieces of the play is a horrific almost unwatchable scene towards the end where O'Brien supervises the torture of Winston, which you need to be warned about that scene. And in fact, in a typical publicity ploy, the producer this week put out a press release to the effect of that no one below the age of 13 will be allowed to see the show. It really is pretty bloody and very, very intense in that torture scene. So anyway, I highly recommend that everyone see this, unless you're under 13, because you won't get in. Despite its flaws, I do think that what Orwell had to say is incredibly prescient to our time in terms of things like doublespeak. Just look at the Trump administration. Also, one of the watchwords of the party, with a capital P, in 1984 is ignorance is strength. I think that certainly applies to Trump and company. And there are so many other things in it that just will make you kind of gasp. So I would say that. Although I don't like the framing device, and there are certain other aspects of the production that I think are confusing and counterproductive, it's well worth seeing. So do try to get there, please.
All right. Ron, what did you think about it?
I agree with a great deal of what Michael has said. It is worth seeing. It's a problematic production. It's very interesting because I saw it at a preview, and then it opened Thursday. And in anticipation of this broadcast, I went and read a number of the major critics. And boy, a lot of them wouldn't take a specific stand. Ben Brantley's review is very all over the place. He never comes out and says it's bad. He never really comes out and says it's good. He doesn't say stay away. He doesn't say go. I think that's kind of a critic's job, by the way. I'm much less interested in the plot device that takes up six paragraphs of a review. I'd rather hear whether it's really worth seeing or not. I would say that because of the strength of the physical production, which Michael didn't touch on, because it's really well designed. It's got a spectacular sound design. I expect it will be nominated for that when they bring back the Sound Awards next spring at the Tonys. In fact, I was sitting near someone who turned out to be a sound designer, and he came specifically to hear the sound. You don't get that too often in a person sharing an armrest with you. And I thought the direction was really interesting and well thought out, and certainly in conjunction with all the elements of the stagecraft involved. This Robert, I'm going to call him Robert Icke, because Robert Icky just doesn't sound right.
you're probably right.
But I saw a production that Robert Icke directed in London back in October. It's a David Hare adaptation of a play, a book, actually, a mystery novel by someone named George Simeon called The Red Barn. And it had Michael Strong and Hope Davis in it. And it was an astonishing physical production. He's kind of the rage there. His Mary Stuart is got marvelous reviews, and he has a Hamlet that's running right now that people are raving over. He's very much in that Ivo van Hove sort of school. If you like those productions, they're physically very exciting and challenging for an audience. I do also want to touch on this notion that now the play is not available to children under the age of 13, because I did have a chance to speak with Reed Burney, who's in the show, and he actually said to me that it made him ill at this particular performance, the one I attended. He saw a 9-year-old boy or somewhere around that age seated very close to the stage with his face in his hands during the horrific torture scene. And it just, Reed was visibly upset that he had made a child so upset. And I don't know if Reed reported that, or if that was one of the straws that broke the camel's back, or unless Michael touched upon this is a publicity ploy, you know, to suddenly start telling people, you know, that this is this member of the great William Castle who made movies in the 60s, you know. If you see the last 10 minutes of this film, you know, they just, it was all to get people into the theaters, you know. But 1984 is a very powerful piece of theater. It's also agitprop. It also is propaganda, which there's nothing wrong with. I mean, And it does deal with this totalitarianistic society. But I have been watching, and I don't know if any of our listeners have been watching, The Handmaid's Tale, which is on Hulu. And they did 10 episodes, which took Margaret Atwood's famous dystopian novel and actually expanded upon it. It did something like what Game of Thrones does. It went beyond the novel. And I thought the 10 episodes were riveting, and I recommend it to anybody interested in seeing how a strong piece of literature can be translated to the screen. And sometimes miniseries really is the way to go. This is 10 hours and well worth your time. But the thing was that having been so elevated by The Handmaid's Tale, which only ended about a week ago, I went into 1984 charged up to see another dystopian drama. And the problem is that the characters in 1984 are not as richly defined as the ones in Handmaid's Tale. They're living, breathing people with backstories that 1984 cannot establish and cannot give us. So you're a little bit stuck with, I don't want to call them stick figures, but, you know, Winston Smith has always been described as an everyman. And everymen, they're difficult as the leads in plays, I have found over the years. I'd rather have a richly more detailed guy. You know, I mean, they can call Willie Loman an everyman. I don't think he's an everyman. I think he's very, very specifically Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman. But Winston is very much an everyman. He's supposed to stand in for what would happen to a person involved in this particular society at this particular year. And for that reason, poor Tom Sturridge has a very difficult assignment as an actor to portray someone who has little backstory, has little in the way of those quirks and feelings and thoughts and things that he can share with us as a character. Instead, we're spaced back to watch this unfold in all its horror. And yes, it's quite effective. And he's good in it. So is Olivia Wilde. So is Reed Birney. It's worth seeing. But just I'm giving you some caveats along the way if you choose to see it at the Hudson Theater. And I would say, go.
So it is scheduled through October 8th as a limited run. And we encourage everybody to at least check out their website and look into us a little further. They have a lot of videos in it floating around that'll give you a flavor for what's going on here. It's interesting what you're saying about the under 13 type of thing. I think most kids, what kind of parent is bringing somebody to 1984? It's not like you're bringing them to Wicked or to,
But as Michael said, we did read it in junior high. I think it's probably still some of those, reading lists, and perhaps the mother or father thought they were doing a good thing, but it's not okay to bring a young child to this play. The torture sequence is horrific. Did you cover your eyes, Michael? I covered my eyes at one moment.
Just about, pretty much. Yeah.
It's interesting that this underlying work, 1984, has been the basis of so many different, the canvas for so many different types of work. Ron, tell us, you've seen some other types of 1984 products, haven't you?
I was curious because it has been adapted as a film more than once, whether or not it had ever been done for the stage before, which it had. But also, I found out it was done as an opera, an American opera. The conductor and composer, Lorin Maazel, late in life, in his 70s, created this. He was 75 years old. And the libretto was by J.D. McClatchy, who is a relatively famous poet, and assisted by the famous Broadway veteran Thomas Meehan of Annie and Hairspray and The Producers. An amazing combination, I think. It was not well received, however. But if you want to make your own decision, it's available on DVD, from what I understand. So you could Google that. And a ballet was done of it as well by a London-based company in northern London, in Yorkshire, Jonathan Watkins. And I saw some clips of it that are available if you Google that. And I thought that was quite interesting. And the one that actually got my real interest raised was that David Bowie was very interested in making a musical out of 1984 way back in the early 70s when Mrs. Orwell, or Mrs. Blair, as you said earlier, Michael, she put the kibosh on it. She would not allow it. And
oh,
so
that's
Bowie,
too bad.
Yeah, and Bowie was left with some songs that he ended up working into another album. So there is a song that David Bowie composed that is recorded, and I'm sure his fans are well aware of, called Big Brother.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Oh, one other thing on the current production that I should mention is Ron talked about not being able to, you know, people not being able to watch the torture scene. What I when I had to close my eyes was there are several occasions where one of my most hated things in the theater happens. Very, 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 very bright lights are shown directly in the audience's eyes. Now, in this case, it serves a dual function. It covers the movement of actors and scenery during changes of scene, because you're blinded so much that you can't see what's happening on stage. Also, arguably, it's all of a piece with the kind of thing that Big Brother and the party would do in order to help, you know, drive people crazy. So it's effective in that way. But I personally, I had to close my eyes during all of those, except I couldn't close my eyes during all of them because some of them are very sudden and very brief. Then there are a couple of two or three extended sequences of lights shining right in your eyes.
And that's something you had a problem with the show the season before last, The Father, which did the blinding white light for the exact same reason, to change the scenery quickly and effectively.
Yes, that's a good point. But yeah. I find it in lots of shows lately, and not always for that reason. Sometimes it's just for effect, and I wish they would stop.
I agree.
Yeah, the lights in the eyes make me nuts. That's just a preference of mine. All right, so let's move forward into our next review of the morning. Michael, you got a chance to see I'm very jealous. A one night only performance of We'll Take a Glass, which was sort of a tribute to Forrest and Wright. So tell us about how this came about and what your thoughts on it were.
Actually, We'll Take a Glass Together, which is also a title of a song from Grand Hotel, a show for which Wright and Forrest wrote some of the songs, about half maybe, and then Maury Yeston came in and wrote some others. So that's a hybrid score, but a very good score overall. And that show, as I think we mentioned, is going to be coming back. Encores is doing it next
season.
That's
correct. Yeah.
So people will be able to see, people who know and people who don't know, Grand Hotel will be able to see it at Encores. Wright and Forrest are also very famous for two or three shows in which they adapted the music of classical composers to Broadway. Kismet is, I think it's fair to say, their biggest hit, but also Song of Norway, which was not a hit, but there is a film version of it. And the show Keen also has some of that in it. This was a one night only production at the Lang Recital Hall at Hunter College. A production of the Ziegfeld Society, put together by and starring Walter Willison, who was in the Grand Hotel on Broadway, and also had worked with a new Wright and Forrest really quite well. This had a wonderful cast: Karen Akers, also from Grand Hotel, Marcy DeJong Manfredi, Katie Dixon, John and Matthew Drinkwater, Diane Finley, Lee Horwin, Heather McRae, Lynette Perry, who hasn't been, I haven't seen her on stage in a while. It was great to see her again. Walter Willison and the amazing Lilian Montevecchi. And they really went through a very generous program of Wright and Forrest songs from various properties, including the Wright and Forrest version of Anya. Well, that was the original title of it, which is even more interesting to see now that Anastasia by two other composers is on Broadway. And so, this was a really wonderful evening of the kind of music that especially the more classical stuff you don't often hear on Broadway anymore. But Wright and Forrest were were really an amazing team, and it's they were so, so popular in their day. So I think that they were a wonderful choice for a tribute concert like this. And the Ziegfeld Society does lots of interesting stuff of that type. So keep them on your radar as well. I'd highly recommend you do so.
And Wright and Forrest also contributed so many songs to what was then known as the Hit Parade. I mean, everybody recorded Stranger in Paradise and Baubles, Bangles, and Beads. I mean, from Sinatra on down. And it's very funny because I went to see The Government Inspector, which you had reviewed in a previous broadcast, and they used the Russian music of Borodin, which is where Wright and Forrest grabbed their basic score from for Kismet. As Michael had mentioned, they were very famous for taking terrific classical tunes and turning them into Broadway-style songs, which was really a very special thing and an original thing to do that certainly has gone out of favor. But they were wildly successful at it. So hearing those songs last night, you know, I'm sitting there waiting for Government Inspector to begin, and I'm going to the Arabian Nights of Kismet. Had one of the opposite, the Bard and the Russian thing didn't work for me. I'm singing the words to gesticulate before the show started. I'm sure Peter Felicia would have been doing the exact same thing.
Wright and Forrest also had some hits before they even started working for Broadway, one of the biggest of which was something called the Donkey Serenade.
That's correct. Very strange song.
I've actually performed that song.
Really?
Yes, I have. Walter Willison gave it to me as part of a fundraiser that we did many, many years ago. Yeah, I did. I did an evening of Wright and Forrest songs. I want to say in the late '90s or something like that.
I had no idea that was Wright and Forrest. In fact, it's on the soundtrack of Woody Allen's film Radio Days, and I used to love that soundtrack. But I would tend to skip the Donkey Serenade.
Yeah, Wright and Forrest. We did a bunch of their film songs, the songs that they wrote for when they were back in the studio system where they got their start. And they were writers who knew each other from seemingly from birth, if not just after birth, together from 1914 until their passing.
Yes.
Until their pad, they lived into their 90s or so.
And they were like ostensibly a couple, were they not?
Yeah. And I guess it was an era where that wasn't discussed. And it was kind of amazing when I forget which one died first, but I think they died.
Chet passed away first.
Yeah. And then it started to come out, and it's like, oh, for God's sake, you know, it's, you know, here we are, and this is the world that we lived in where something like that.
Well, this is maybe a month or two ago when all of a sudden it was huge news that Barry Manilow was gay.
Right.
And a friend of mine's wrote the best comment I had seen about it was like, the news shouldn't be that Barry Manilow is gay. The news should be how great it is that he and his partner have been together for so long.
Exactly.
That's what we should be celebrating.
Exactly.
On a Pride weekend.
I'm still
weekend.
Wondering, does it mean that Wright and Forrest got two tickets to the Tony Awards? I guess they did.
I sense a segue coming here.
So it has been many, many, many years since I was in the front of house for the Tony Awards. I guess I have not seen it as an audience member live. I've been mostly in the press room for the last 15 years or so. But Ron, you got a chance to see the Tony Awards live, and tell us what was going on in those. My favorite part about it was the commercial segments that are not broadcast.
Yeah.
When they go to commercial, there's always funny things that happen.
Well, it was a great night. And for me, a return to the Tony Awards. In my book, Up in the Cheap Seats, I tell about the night I went to the Tony Awards in 1972 when I was 15. So this is 45 years later that I went back to the Tonys, and I brought my ticket stub with me as a talisman, and I was pulling it out of my pocket all evening because I was showing it to everybody because it had a $10 price tag on it. It was the last row of the Broadway theater. And I want you to know that I had to pay $25 to rent my tuxedo. So the tuxedo was 2.5 times the cost of my ticket. All right. We're not going to talk about how much it cost for me to go to the Tonys last Sunday night. But I was not in the cheap seats, and happily so, because I was seated amongst the nominees. I was with I had Lynn Nottage and Paula Vogel right behind me. I had Jennifer Ely and John Douglas Thompson and Johanna Day right in front of me and by my side. And it was just great to be in the thick of it. And yes, the interstitials, the commercial breaks, are used to give out some awards. They give out a few before the show, and then they give out a few during the show. And those segments were hosted by a charming duo of Brian D'Arcy James and Jonathan Groff. We had two of the kings from Hamilton, and they were pretty adorable. And you got people to give speeches that nobody had to get, you know, pulled off stage with the hook. The commercial breaks are long enough to handle a 3-4 minute speech, although none of them really went that long. But unfortunately, the little tiny bits that they give you on the actual broadcast, because there's somebody hurriedly, you know, in an editing bay trying to grab just a line from the lighting designer's speech or the line from the choreographer's speech, and you just can't get it that way. And some of the speeches were excellent. Those speeches were marvelous, and I think available now online if you want to go look them up at the TonyAwards.org website. Because in particular, Andy Blankenbuehler's speech about bringing his grandfather's medal from World War II up on stage with him. I mean, very touching, beautiful speeches. And it was just terrific to be part of that world of excitement of not knowing, you know, who was going to win. It was a terrific night for that. There were a lot of tight categories and very few standing ovations. That was my biggest surprise. I can tell you there were only two that were genuine from the heart, the entire theater up and down. One was James Earl Jones, which was in the early part of the broadcast. So prior to 8 p.m., there was about a half an hour's worth of a ceremony. And James Earl Jones got a well-deserved standing ovation. And the second standing ovation was for Jill Biden, which I think the television broadcast was able to show you by way of the cameras. Which was its own kind of a political statement, and that was kind of touching. I guess the one that was most surprising to me that didn't occur was Bette Midler did not get a standing ovation when she won Best Actress, and I thought that was going to be the single, you know, lock of the evening. As big a lock as her award was, I thought a standing ovation was going to happen.
Well, I think I may have mentioned this last time, but and it's so hard to really be sure about this, but I sense that there is a certain amount of bad feeling because of what happened with No Number from Hello Dolly being performed during the Tonys.
Well, that's the conclusion I drew from it.
Yeah.
That's the conclusion I drew.
What was it like to be in the theater as she went on and on and on and shouted and shouted down the orchestra?
Well, I loved it. I mean, I thought I was completely in her pocket. I mean, I've been in her pocket since the show opened. I mean, she's extraordinary in it. And she knows how to get up in front of an audience and just tuck them away in her back pocket. And I would say walk off the stage. But in this particular stance, no, not walk off the stage. She wanted to get her points across. And I don't think I've ever seen anybody shout down an orchestra into complete silence. I mean, she silenced them. And then went on to actually have the best part of her speech at the very end, which I think made the whole thing worthwhile, that she ended on such a high, going back to the history of the show and what it meant to people and what it meant to Broadway. But I think it was a terrible mistake not to do a number from that really showcased Hello Dolly, because the number of David Hyde Pierce, as charming as it is just a simple number done in front of a curtain, and we don't understand why it won, you know, the best costumes. And you know, for future... you know, people are going to go back and look at the 2017 Tonys and go, oh, that was the season when Bette Midler conquered Broadway and Hello Dolly. I can't wait to see it. Well, you mean there's no number from Hello Dolly?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, to go back to that 1972 Tony Awards that I attended.
Right.
That was the year of Two Gentlemen of Verona and Follies, neither of which performed on the broadcast, nor did Grease, the other show nominated for Best Musical. But they did numbers from Jesus Christ Superstar. I mean, it was a very bizarre thing that Alexander Cohen, the producer back then, decided to do. And the rules are different now. And obviously, you get numbers from all the shows, including ones that aren't even nominated. Like Bandstand's number went over great and actually helped their box office.
Yes.
Which is a terrific thing. I remember the year that they opened the Tonys with On Broadway from Smokey Joe's Cafe, which extended that show's run by years. So these can be very effective tools. Sure, Hello Dolly doesn't need the business, but we all wanted to see Bette Midler do a bit of it. And I'm sorry, for whatever reasons it turned out to be, that it didn't happen.
The Tony Awards are a yearbook. It's a historical document for us.
Yes.
Not only for us who are New Yorkers who get to see it, but really for those people that don't get to go to Broadway. That's the people I'm talking about.
Well, when I'm trying to find out information about a show that was before my time, the Tony Awards stuff on YouTube is the first thing that I look to try to, you know, find out if they did a number and what it was and how it was received and the feel for it. It's a shame.
I mean, think about if Patti LuPone didn't perform Everything's Coming Up Roses the year she won the Tony for Gypsy, right? I mean, that was one of the most stunning performances we've ever had on the Tonys. And, you know, if she'd said, nah, I'm tired, we would have been just, it's not
before,
right.
Before we move on to our next topic, I want to remind our listeners that we have all of the award speeches, including the ones that were not broadcast, on the front page of BroadwayStars.com.
Oh, that's wonderful.
You can go right to Broadway Stars and see all the speeches right there. All right. Next up, Ron, you got a chance to see Cost of Living, which we've already talked about. But tell us, what were your thoughts about it?
Well, I didn't know anything about this play before I went to see it. I was taken to see it, and I've been playing a little game with myself, and I want to suggest it to both you guys as well as to your listeners. I don't open the program. I fly blind. I don't want to know where the show is set, what year it's set in, how many characters there are, just nothing about it. I just want it to unfurl in front of me. And when it's a show like Cost of Living, which is relatively short with no intermission, I really find the journey is a more exciting one. And in particular, in this case, very exciting, because I had no idea it was going to deal with two people who were in wheelchairs. And as you and Peter discussed in your discussion about it, Michael, I did spend a moment going, oh, that must be a trick wheelchair for that actress. Do you know? She's hiding her legs very well, until I realized that she indeed, is a paraplegic. And the other gentleman who really has cerebral palsy, I thought perhaps was acting. And then it wasn't till the curtain call where he comes out and is clearly walking, but with a pronounced different style of gait than people without cerebral palsy walk with, and that she came out on two prosthetic legs. And it was I was so pleased to not be judging them based on, oh, they're doing awfully well for people with those particular disabilities. I was able to just watch them as actors. And I think this playwright is a very, very, very good writer. I thought that I know you guys had this one problem with this one section of the play where the young woman comes on what she thinks might be a date with the gentleman that she's working for as sort of nursemaid.
Right.
And I think that you were a little more okay with it than Peter was, Michael.
Yeah, Peter had a problem with it. I understood his point. I just didn't feel quite as strongly as he did about it.
Yeah, and I thought there was a moment where that character did go, oh, you're kind of mistaken. And Peter wanted a much bigger revelation of, oh, I'm so sorry, my God. But I think that guy was so caught up in his own excitement about what was going to be happening, he wasn't in touch with the other character's feelings. And so I bought it. But I'm afraid I can't recall her name. She has a Polish name, the playwright. And
I think it's pronounced Martina Majok.
Majok, that's correct. I think she's a playwright to look out for. So I would recommend Cost of Living because I believe it's still running and should be seen by anyone who likes a good play. And I know that I've destroyed the flying blind, don't open your program element of it, but I still think it's a very, very strong piece of theater.
Well, it's interesting because I was listening back to what I had said about it, and I realized later that I did not specify that these two actors actually are disabled.
That's correct. Yeah.
That's the correct word. And in a way, I guess it's good that I didn't, because it just shows that it was so organic and integral to the play. It wasn't a gimmick in any way.
Not in any way.
So maybe it's okay that I hadn't mentioned it, and now we have.
All right. So next up, Michael, you got to see Afterglow at the Loft at the Davenport Theater. So tell us about Afterglow.
Yeah, I don't think I need to spend too much time on this. It's a play by S. Asher Gelman, written and directed by him, which is almost always a mistake. And in this case, I think it was a mistake specifically for the reason that it went on much longer than it needed to make the point. This is a story about the first thing we see is it's in at the Loft at the Davenport Theater on 45th Street. So the audience is on opposite sides of the playing space, only two sides, not three or four. And in the middle there is the playing space. And initially there's a sort of a raised area that was initially surrounded by white drapes or curtains where you could see shadows through it, but it wasn't transparent or anything. And the first thing we hear is, it's hard to tell for sure, but at least two people having sex. And then the curtain or drapes drop, and we see that it's actually three people. And there are three guys in the play. It's three characters: Josh, played by Brandon Hogginson, Darius, played by Patrick Riley, and Alex, played by Robbie Simpson. And they have just had very, very energetic sex. They are completely naked, all three of them. This play, you should know going in, if you do go in, has more nudity than any other play I have ever seen, and more nudity in sexual situations, which you don't see very often. So just be aware of that. I think it's fair to say that maybe it's considered a selling point. So I don't think that anyone
did they
will mind.
Make a did they have a press release saying nobody under 13 should come to it?
I don't know, but I guess this is a being viewed as a gay pride production, because it's playing through August 5th, and it opened a couple of weeks ago, or began performances a couple of weeks ago. Get to the point, it's about this couple who bring a third into their situation. It's about polyamory, and rather predictably, it's about the problems that arise when that – or that can arise when that happens, because it's unlikely that the third person will not maybe start to become closer to one of the two people in the couple, and that's what happens here. I think a tremendous amount of the play was very cliched and predictable, but I will say that every now and then a line or two came through that really made you think about the situation in a different way. So I think that there is a good play there, and it would have been a better play if it had been much shorter, and probably not if it had not been directed by the person who wrote it, and vice versa.
Theater is so collaborative. It's so rare that we ever see something that is written by and booked by and directed by and choreographed by and starring by that is ever successful by.
Yeah. I mean, there have been some, but not many.
Yeah, no. I think that's the exception to the rule where that's really good. It's important to get a collaborative thing together there. All right. So, Ron, you got a chance to see The Government Inspector down at Red Bull. So tell us about The Government Inspector.
Well, this is, if you like farce, this is just one of the most enjoyable and longstanding works that we've had in the repertoire. There was a production that I saw back in 1978 at the Circle in the Square when it was called The Inspector General instead of The Government Inspector. And that production was really funny and had Max Wright, who was a very overwrought comedic actor, in the role that Michael Urie is playing. And Bob Balaban was actually nominated for a Tony Award for playing his servant, Ossip, who in this production is played by Arnie Burton, who doubles as the postman and does really, really extraordinary work. But the cast has Broadway veterans like Mary Testa and Michael McGraw, and even Mary Lou Rosato, who is an actress who was part of that very first and most famous Juilliard company, John Houseman's very first acting company that started that school that produced Patti LuPone and Kevin Kline and David Ogden Stiers. And Mary Lou Rosato was in that Inspector General, and now she's in this one all these years later. And it's very well staged by the artistic director of that company, the Red Bull Theater, and the audience had a fantastic time. It was closing night technically last night, but the show is reopening. It's been enough of a success to move over to the New World stages, and I was told that they're able to move that set very easily. It's a very odd set. You know, it's two-tiered. You watch the first half of the play on the bottom tier and basically the second half of the play on the upper tier. So if you're seated down below, you do have a gaze of looking up for about two-thirds of the play. I was seated in around row F, which is just about perfect. So if you are thinking of seeing it at New World Stages, this is one of those rare shows where sitting close is not as great as sitting a bit further back. But it's hilarious. And I think Jeffrey Hatcher's adaptation, for the most part, is very funny. There's a few jokes in there that are real groaners, and certain ones that met with, you know, absolutely, you know, crickets after they were said. So he's absolutely, you know, throwing everything against the wall and hoping it all sticks.
Yes.
You definitely forgive those lines that don't go over for the ones that do. And again, Michael Urie's physical performance, I had only seen him on stage in Buyer and Seller, which is a one-man show that he was expert in. And it was at that show that I realized, oh my God, you know, this guy has got theater chops. And of course, found out he went to Juilliard. And you really see it in this production, because that production, Buyer and Seller, did not at all tap into his physical comedy. He is a clown of the Kevin Kline variety. It makes you yearn to see him in things that would encourage him to go with that elastic Martin Short kind of quality that came through. I'm sorry I didn't see him when he replaced in the Daniel Radcliffe production of How to Succeed from a few years ago. He went on to play Bud Frump, and must have really stolen it, if I can imagine.
He was brilliant.
Yes. I mean, it's he is a really talented guy, and I'm very excited that he is going to star in Torch Song Trilogy for the Manhattan
I don't
Club.
Think so.
No, I had it confirmed last night.
Oh, did you?
Yes, because there was some talk. The pilot that he had shot was picked up, and suddenly Manhattan Theater Club had dropped his name from ads. I got a mailer in the mail that did not mention who was starring in Torch Song when earlier. Right. So I asked, and I found out, no, he is going to do the show.
Well, that's big news, Ron. Thank you.
Well, yeah. I mean, it wasn't from his mouth, but from a fellow cast members who said, yeah, he's going to do it. And he's going to be great. And I mean, I'm very excited about that.
Wow. Breaking news here.
Let's hope.
I'm so happy that this production is transferring. It's only for 6 weeks, so don't dawdle. And, you know, I mean, obviously it costs money to transfer a show, even if it's a basically simple set, which this one is not that simple. I think they're probably doing it not with an eye necessarily towards making a whole lot of money, but just because they want more people to see this really, really excellent production.
And I think expand the Red Bull brand.
Yes.
People should know this company's mandate is to do productions of classics. Am I correct, or is it classics with a very specific?
Yes, thing? Yes. They've done wonderful shows that I've seen. Yeah. Just really, really great stuff.
All right. So before we wrap up today, Ron, you are going to be the envy of many, as you are going to get a chance to see another performance of Dear Evan Hansen.
Yes, a ninth performance this week of Dear Evan Hansen.
Yeah, Dear Evan Hansen is doing an Actors Fund performance. Is it tonight, Sunday evening?
It is at 8 o'clock tonight. The Actors Fund often will ask a hit show to contribute to their charity by offering up a ninth performance, in which these actors, I mean, especially a show like Dear Evan Hansen, which is such an emotional drain, to do a ninth performance for free. I believe the stagehands are paid. I believe those union rules get in the way a bit. But the actors give of their time and effort and energy for free to a very worthy charity. The Actors Fund has been around for over 100 years. I give generously to it. I suggest any listeners within shouting distance should. It helps actors in need. If you can't pay your rent, if you need a pair of shoes, it's an extraordinary charity. Brian Stokes Mitchell's been its titular spokesman for many years now and does wonderful work for them. And anybody who's been a part of this organization is devoted to it. So I'm happy to give them some money. I'm happy I'm finally being able to take my daughter. She's been very anxious to see it. She's 26. It's a belated birthday present for her. I saw the production at Second Stage. Then I saw it when it moved to Broadway at the Music Box last fall. I think it was the best musical of the season, and I'm thrilled to see it for a third time. Especially, as we all know, we're counting down the days to Ben Platt's departure, and woe to the soul that must take over that role, although there will be many over the years. This show is going to be done forever and a day, I believe, and not only in regional theaters, but, oh my gosh, when the rights to schools for colleges and high schools goes out, Dear Evan Hansen is going to be one of the most popular titles there is.
On a related note, tomorrow, Monday the 26th, is the National High School Theater Awards, otherwise known as the Jimmy Awards. And it is interesting. I've gone to all of them, I believe, since the first one. And it used to be it was always a great event from the beginning. It didn't seem like when it started that it was that high profile and that hard to get into. But it has become more and more popular as the years have gone by, to the point where now, and in addition to that, this year it's being hosted by, guess who? Ben Platt. Well, I fortunately asked about press tickets several weeks ago, and then I finally got my go-ahead. And then I had a friend who wanted to go, and I said, well, I don't think it'll be that difficult for you to get in. And so I started to make calls, and it is impossible to get a ticket. I think between a combination of the awards becoming more popular and also Ben Platt hosting it, which is a perfect kind of event for him to host because it's this focus on young people, high school talented high school people.
Well, speaking of high school and Ben Platt, I lived in Los Angeles for 30 years. I raised my children there
because
they loved to do theater. I saw Ben Platt as Skye Masterson in Guys and Dolls when he was in middle school.
Amazing.
And his Miss Adelaide was Beanie Feldstein, who is appearing in Hello Dolly around the corner from Dear Evan Hansen. They're very good friends, but I saw them as Miss Adelaide and Skye. I mean, it's just too great.
You were in the right place at the right time.
Oh, I'll tell you one more because your listeners will adore this. I went to a production of Bye Bye Birdie, one of many. I think I've seen Bye Bye Birdie more than any other musical. And this production had Rob Reiner's son as Conrad Birdie. It had Tracy Ullman's son as Harry McAfee, the Paul Lynde role. And as Kim McAfee, the daughter of Josh Brolin and Diane Lane, who then had her grandmother, Barbara Streisand, in the audience the day I went. That's really just, that's all there is to say about that.
Well, I don't think we can top that, so I think we better wrap up for today. I want to remind listeners that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have an episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the iHeartRadio app. Google Play also plays us. iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher. You can find us everywhere, including Broadway World Radio. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Michael, for Ron, for me, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today can be found in the show notes at BroadwayRadio.com. as we said, Peter was unexpectedly absent, so we don't have an answer to last week's trivia, but Ron has come up with a trivia question for this week. So, Ron, why don't you give us that trivia question?
I hope I'm correct in my answer, because I tried to find this answer online, but I had to do my own legwork. So here goes.
Okay.
With the Tony Awards fresh on our minds and in our discussions, Jane Greenwood finally won her Tony Award after 21 nominations. But now, someone has taken on the mantle of being the oldest living person nominated for the most Tonys without a single win. The question then, who is it? And how many Tonys have they been nominated for?
Huh. That's a great question. All right. So if you have an answer to that, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com and we will let you know if you get onto the right track there. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Ron Fassler, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So long.